It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, walking. In today's car culture, it can be a radical thing to see the world on foot, to step out of your comfort zone, so to speak. In fact, if you walk long enough and far enough, it can change your life.
Oh my God. What have I done?
I'm sorry you have to walk 1,000 miles just to...
Finish that sentence. Why do I have to walk 1,000 miles?
Happy trails, Cheryl. Turn
away. I'd started walking in the Mojave Desert, and I didn't plan to stop until I touched the Oregon-Washington border.
You get lonely. I'm lonelier in my real life than I am out here.
I looked south to the wild land that had schooled and scorched me and considered my options. There was only one. Keep walking.
Cheryl Strayed's memoir, Wild, is the story of an epic walk she took as a young woman across 1,000 miles of the Pacific Crest Trail, alone. Her mother had just died. Her marriage had failed, and she was floundering. But that walk saved her life. And if you're wondering why this story has struck such a chord, especially with women, well, maybe because it taps into something archetypal. Cheryl, at its most elemental, Wild is the story of a young woman who sets out on a walk that transforms her. And in that sense, it's the same mythic story structure as, I don't know, the Odyssey. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely, I see it that way. Those ancient stories are in my bones. The hero's journey, where somebody is compelled to go into the darkness, has to slay those dragons and demons, and returns altered from that experience. And in fact,
were you aware of that at the time? Because when you write it, you know, there's a lot about hiking and trail mix and how much your boots hurt.
That's right. That's right. And so it was more of an intuitive sense that that's what I was doing. But I will say there was a point that I became aware of it. And it was really through the writing that I found it, writing the particular, writing about that really heavy pack. There's this scene in Wild where I'm first in that motel room on day one of my hike, and I can't get my pack. I can't get it on because I can't lift it. And I realized that I was telling a story about how it is that we bear the unbearable, and not just how I literally lifted that pack, but how in a deeper sense I figured out how to thrive in the world without somebody who seemed essential to me, my mom. And the deal about that is that we all have to do that. We all have to bear something we can't bear.
We all have our own packs.
That's right. And they take different form and shape, and they have different weights. And so that's where the story takes on, I guess, that you use that word mythic standing, because people recognize themselves in it.
Could we talk a bit about the walking part? I was thinking that experience of going into the wilderness, encountering your own, you know, inner demons, and learning to be alone. You didn't have to be walking to do those things. You could have gone on a Zen Buddhist retreat. You could have holed up in a cabin someplace and seen nobody for 3 months. How important was the walking to the transformation?
I think the walking was really important. For one thing, it is in its own monotony a kind of meditation. The way you walk is doing the same thing over and over again, one foot in front of the other. That also has metaphorical resonance, right? It's just the act of moving forward. And I think in so many ways, before I took my hike, I was caught up in the emotion of my loss, the psychic, psychological, spiritual suffering. And the walk allowed me to get out of my head and into my body and to focus not on what hurt in that kind of emotional way, but what hurt in the physical way. My feet were blistered. The pack was heavy. The terrain was rough. And I had a lot of miles to cover every day up and down mountains. One of the hallmarks throughout cultures and time, when we look at rites of passage, and by that I mean really somebody having to let go of or relinquish one part of their life and move into the next, and that's what I was certainly doing on the PCT, is there's always a physical element. There's always a solitary element. There's always some exertion and some deprivation and a lot of silence. And I think walking really provides us with all of those things.
You did run into people on the trail who often seemed to have their own almost mythic take on what you were doing, on the kind of walk you were doing. I was thinking about you ran into a guy, I can't remember his name, who said, well, you're on a spirit walk.
Mm-hmm. Paco, yeah. He was fishing with his friends, and we shared a meal and talked, and he could see what I was doing. It was true. He was right. I was on a spirit walk. I went out there seeking peace and solace and to find my center again. And before my walk, I thought what that might look like is Hollywood, you know, beautiful, lots of sunsets with me weeping upon them and reflecting upon everything in my life. And I guess that's what I mean about the difference with walking is that I got exactly what I was looking for, but it came in a different way. It came not through peaceful sunsets, though I had plenty of those, but rather through that physical exertion, having to test myself physically to see how far I could go and how much I could endure. And it turned out to be a lot. You know, the trail demanded a lot.
Your toenails fell off.
My toenails fell off. But the thing is, too, is what it turned out for me in life. My life demanded a lot, too. I had to lose my mom at 22. I had to accept that I never would have a good father and other things, you know, like we all do. I don't mean to say I'm the only one who's had to do those things, but somehow having to say, okay, I can let go of six toenails helped me let go of those other things.
There's another guy you encountered, a reporter for Hobo Times magazine.
Yes.
He kept insisting you were a hobo, which irritated the hell out of you at
it
the time.
It did. I was standing by the side of the road trying to hitchhike. Because the year I hiked the PCT, there was so much snow that there were big sections that were impassable. And so I had to, you know, hitchhike on the road sort of around those sections to get back on the trail at lower elevations. And this car pulled over, and a young man who was about my age in his 20s got out. And he said, look, I can't give you a ride, because his car was crammed full of stuff, but I'm a reporter for the Hobo Times. And of course, I immediately said, oh, that's great, but I'm not a hobo. The fun thing about that experience was it was actually an experience I had over and over again. When I would come into a little town or a place to pick up one of my resupply boxes, and I did look like a hobo. PCT hikers are hairy and dirty and sweaty, and they haven't had a shower for 2 weeks, and they're carrying everything on their back. And so there is some, you know, I had some fun with that.
The irony is, having written this book about this epic walk, you now, of course, are far too busy traveling the country, lecturing, doing book tours. And when you're not doing that, you're a mom.
That's right. Walking has become a challenge. I have never gone through a phase of my life that I've had so little walking in my life. And I feel it. You know, it's life out of balance. I've had to be the ambassador for Wild, and I've had the privilege of that. I feel so grateful for it. But yes, I would like things to calm down so I can go back to walking more.
Well, what I was wondering is, what do you think as a parent, as a mother, about is part of what we hope to do in parenting to prepare your kids to go out and have the solo experience? And I'm not talking literally, I'm talking metaphorically. You know, how do you raise kids who are able to do what you did, go out alone into the wilderness of their life and make their way?
Well, that is a profound question, and I don't know the answer to it. I'm so much in the thick of motherhood right now, and I try to, you know, expose them to experiences that will allow them to be put in touch with that internal sense of resilience that I think that we need in order to find our way through the wilderness, like we all have to do. We all have the wilderness of our life. We all have to find out who we are, to test ourselves against something so that we can find our strength, to gather ourselves when we lose our way, find our way back, find our way out. Those are all things I had to do. And of course, I had to do that from a place of deep sorrow. And I hope that my kids don't have that kind of youth. And yet it's always the great contradiction, I think, of parenthood is so many of us know that the best things we learned the hard way. We learned because we had to suffer, because we had to accept things that we didn't want to accept, that we had to go outside of the comfort zone and make mistakes and have regrets and all of those things. We know those are powerful lessons. And yet we're all terrified that our kids will have them.
Would you want your kids at some point to go off on a solo long-distance hike?
Absolutely. I hope they will. I would be worried sick about them. I always joke if they do that, I would have a computer chip, a GPS tracker or something implanted into their heads so I could follow their every move. But of course, I would worry, but I want them to do something like that. I want them to choose to do life-affirming, challenging, exciting things that open them up to themselves and the world. Those are the kinds of kids I want to raise. I think that those are the best people in the world, really. They kind of do that thing, like I said, go outside of the comfort zone and dare to, extend themselves in some way.
Cheryl Strayed, talking about her memoir, Wild. The film adaptation stars Reese Witherspoon. Speaking of movies, did you know that the legendary film director Werner Herzog is also an obsessive walker? In fact, he once walked from Munich to Paris in the winter. It took him 3 weeks. That was a long time ago, but he still likes to walk.
As you know, I run my own film school, the Rogue Film School, which is some sort of, it's a guerrilla-type film school. And one of the things I try to hammer in, travel on foot. I'm speaking of traveling because I would cover large distances and I would not be a backpacker. I don't carry my tent, my sleeping bag, my cooking utensils, so I do not carry my living room and my kitchen with me. So you are exposed and you have to ask a farmer to sleep in the barn, or you sleep under a bridge, or I would open with little surgical tools, safety locks, and move into an abandoned house or vacation home and lock it up when I leave. But I would say traveling on foot has one specific quality, and I can say it only in a dictum. The world reveals itself to those who travel on foot. You have to do it, the world all of a sudden becomes understandable. It reveals itself, it opens itself. You start to focus on the essentials. You are a lot into fantasies, music. It's a strange thing, and I advise everyone, do some traveling on foot at least once in a while, and the benefits are enormous.
Werner Herzog is a legendary film director, but maybe deserves to be celebrated as a legendary walker, too. Actually, he once wrote a book that is considered a walking classic. It's the story of his winter pilgrimage from Munich to Paris. It's called Walking in Ice, soon to be reissued. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We've been talking about how walking can change and even save lives. So here's the story of another woman who deserves to have a film made about her, Emma Gatewood, the first woman to hike the entire Appalachian Trail. She was a grandmother, actually she was a great-grandmother, when she set out to walk 2,000 miles alone. Ben Montgomery tells her story in a book called Grandma Gatewood's Walk.
She started in 1955 at the age of 67. She secretly left home, didn't tell her children or her grandchildren. She was about 800 miles into her walk before she let anybody know. And she dropped a postcard in the mail to her kids back home. And it said essentially, you know, when I told you I was going to take a walk, I actually meant I'm trying to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail.
She's the mother of 11 kids, grandmother of 23.
Right.
Leaves her small Ohio hometown with a change of clothes and less than $200. What possessed her to want to do that?
Well, that's a great question, and I spent no short amount of time trying to figure it out. She had been married for 30 years to an oppressive, hard-fisted man in a small town that knew how to keep secrets. And she had been beaten starting on her wedding night. It was the first time he struck her, and it didn't stop. She wrote in her diary that she was pregnant 11 times. I'm sorry, 13 times. She miscarried twice, but she said she never bore a child without him assaulting her during her pregnancy. She finally got, I think she was up against the wall. She had taken an especially bad beating that nearly killed her, broke a rib, broke a tooth. He had sort of ripped part of her ear off, and she decided, this is it, I've got to get away. And she mustered up the nerve to file for divorce. And it's around this time that she started taking very long walks.
Well, she had no real wilderness or survival training. Not only that, she'd lit out with no map, no tent, no sleeping bag. I mean, frankly, it sounds like suicide.
She was tough as nails. About the only training she had was being a farmer's wife, and she worked alongside the men every day, sun up to sundown. So she was no stranger to that form of survival. But yes, you're right. She was completely unprepared for a 2,050-mile walk. What she did have, she stuffed inside a handmade denim drawstring sack, which she slung over her shoulder.
She didn't even take any food with her, really, did she?
She brought along some cheese and some peanuts and some raisins and some bouillon cubes to suck on for the sodium. She ate wild strawberries and something she liked to call sorrel salad. Sorrel is a grass that grows along the AT. She called it a sorrel salad. Basically, she's just eating grass. Beyond what she could find beside the trail, she was not ever afraid of, if she was very hungry, of walking up to the nearest house and knocking on the door. In fact, one gentleman who met her when he was a boy, his parents lived in a house along the AT in New Hampshire. He recalls her showing up one day, knocking on the door, and his mother was cooking dinner. And his mother opens the door, and Emma says, "How you doing? I'm Grandma Gatewood. What's for dinner?" She just kind of came in and sat down and, you know, enjoyed herself. So that's how she made it, the kindness of strangers.
She started hiking in the summer, but, you know, it took her months to get up north, and the weather got gradually worse. How did she handle the cold?
She found some men's clothing along the trail, including a wool vest, which she bundled up in. She would often heat up flat rocks on a fire and lie on those for warmth. But for the most part, she just toughed it out. Wow. In fact, the day she climbed Mount Katahdin, she had sprained a knee and she had broken out one lens of her glasses. She was virtually blind without her glasses. And so she's having a hard time seeing, and it's sleeting, and she's climbing a mountain. This is a rugged woman.
Now, was she ever in real danger aside from exposure on the trail?
She had a run-in with a bear, which she scared off with her umbrella. In the summer of 1955, two hurricanes made landfall off the coast of North Carolina back-to-back within 7 days of each other, and they raked up the eastern seaboard and stalled out over New England, dumping unprecedented amounts of rain on the Appalachian chain in that area. And those floods killed 211 people. There's no evidence in any of her diaries, any of her writings, that she even knew she was walking through hurricanes. She'd write things like, "Slogged 9 miles through wind and rain today," you know, that kind of thing. But
meanwhile, governors were declaring states of emergency,
and helicopters were rescuing people from church camps. And yeah, I don't know that she ever knew that they were hurricanes.
Well, now at some point, word got out about her hike. Reporters began to follow her, and then she became a folk hero, right?
Reporters in Roanoke, Virginia, who had heard about her, tracked her down. It took them several days to find her, and she reluctantly told them her story. But once that hit the paper, boy, every town she walked through, there seemed to be another reporter waiting for her. She didn't mind talking to people, but what bothered her was they always wanted her to stop moving. She said, you know, it's hard for me to get going again. These legs are 67 years old, so if I stop, it's hard for me to get going. But the story spread like wildfire, and probably the last 2 weeks or 10 days of her through hike, boy, there were daily dispatches from the Associated Press and the United Press International going out.
What was it about her and her trek that captured the public's imagination so much?
Well, this was an interesting year in American history. The 1950s were one of the biggest roads building decades in United States history. There were millions of dollars being pumped into the building, the interstate highway system. This dovetailed with the affordability of the American automobile. And what you saw was this slow decline in walking and getting out. In fact, the very year that Emma hiked the AT, 1955, there was a big gathering of family doctors in Los Angeles, and two emissaries from the sports world delivered the keynote speech. And they said, we, for the first time ever, are having to build muscle in young men, not loosen muscle. Kids were, their physiques had changed in their lifetimes. And so I think what she gave people was a reminder that there's something special about walking. And she romanticized it in this really interesting way. People ask her, why are you doing this? And she said, I just wanted to see what was over the next hill, then what was over the hill beyond that.
One of the things I love most about her is she was a very plain-spoken, blunt woman. Like, you tell a story about, I think it was 1963, and she met a hiker on the trail, and he said, oh, wow, Grandma Gatewood, and asked her what part of the trail she liked best, and she said, going downhill, Sonny.
She had a way with words. She was visiting, late in life, she was visiting a nephew in Pensacola, Florida, and they went to an all-you-can-eat seafood buffet and loaded their plates with peel-and-eat shrimp. And the gentleman told me that he got back to the table and kind of put his head down and started eating his shrimp, and he was discarding the shells in a little bowl beside him. And he had looked up and looked across the table at Aunt Emma, and she had finished her plate. There wasn't a tail or a shell anywhere in sight. And he said, well, Aunt Emma, you're not supposed to eat the tails and the shells. And she said, why, we paid for them, didn't we? She was a hoot.
Yeah.
I really did sort of fall in love with her at the end. It was a weird experience for me because I'm writing like the end of the book, and I go out to my shed and just start crying, and I couldn't figure out why. And I was talking to my wife with it one night, and she was like, well, I think you're mourning. You don't want her to die. And it was totally true. Like, I knew her, you know, I knew it was all outlined. I knew how the story was going to end. And I couldn't get my mind around that. I wanted to keep her alive, you know, so.
How old was she when she died?
She was 84 years old, and she had just finished a 48-state trip by bus and caught a cold, you know, near the tail end of that bus trip. And she got back home and tried to go back to work planting a garden and that sort of thing. And she called her son and said, something's not right. I don't feel right. She had never been sick before, and so he called an ambulance. And the story has it that she died just after she hummed a few bars of the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Oh, an amazing woman. I wonder what she'd make of us today.
I think she would think I am a big panty waist. I mean, if you're going to through hike the AT today, you spend $1,000 on gear. You get the best hiking boots, and you get the lightest backpack, and the best hammock, and the best and lightest sleeping bag. And I think she would just laugh at all of that. This was a woman who didn't need anything. She needed a pile of leaves and a little bit of good fortune. And, you know, her father told her, pick up your feet. And I think that's kind of what she did. She just picked up her feet for 2,000 miles.
Emma Gatewood was the first woman to hike the entire Appalachian Trail alone in sneakers. Her fame and outspoken criticism of the sorry state of the trail is probably what saved it from extinction. Ben Montgomery tells her story in his book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk, who won the 2014 National Outdoor Book Award. So let's head across the Atlantic now to Great Britain, home to generations of long-distance walkers, many of whom were also writers. The poet Wordsworth is said to have walked the equivalent of 10 miles a day every day for 50 years. Charles Dickens was famous for his nighttime walks across London, and now we can add another to the list of dedicated British walkers.
I began with one 10-day walk and ended up walking for a year. Time distorted. Some days I was scorched by sun, others battered by wind and snow. Some days the fog and mist closed the landscape. On others the air was clear and the vault of the sky so vast I could see to another age. I was wet and cold, dusty and sweaty, content and sad, welcomed and lonely. It was a year containing 45 days of walking 400 miles and boating another 100. I did count, but who really cares about the number of miles?
Jules Priddy is an environmental biologist who writes about endangered landscapes, rising sea levels, and unsustainable farming practices. But his most personal book is called The Luminous Coast. It's the story of the year he spent walking England's southeastern shoreline. Steve Paulson wanted to know more.
Jules, what's the east coast of England like?
Well, the coast has three sorts of landscape. One, cliffs, mudstone cliffs that are quite crumbly and prone to erosion, shingle and sand beaches, and then a lot of river walls and sea walls where the land is flat and there are marshes leading up to where the sea is. And then those have been protected by building up sea walls over about 1,000 years.
So some of these places you knew well and others were unfamiliar to you.
Very much so, yes. And indeed, even the familiar places where I'd grown up, is when you walk in the back door along the coast as opposed to coming in through roads or paths from on land, you see them quite differently. And there's something that you learn about a particular place by seeing it from a different angle. But of course, in the walking, which is quite a physical thing to do, you discover more things about yourself as well. I mean, a walking journey is a journey outwards as well as a reconnoiter inwards.
So what is it about walking that appeals to you so much?
I think it's something about being kind of, it's an expression of being close to the land, close to places that could have significance to us. It gives us the opportunity to see light and hear sounds and make observations that you wouldn't normally make. To establish memories, because things happen. Sometimes you're very lonely. Sometimes you feel exalted by what you see. But I think it's primarily about getting close to the land and learning what you can from that. In our affluent societies, where we tend to spend a lot of time kind of rather remote from natural places.
Now, you write that this year of walking changed you. Mm. How so?
Well, the first obvious change was a physical one, that having walked on the first long walk of 160 miles, I walked east and north, and so the sun was always off to my right-hand side. And when I got home, I realized that if I put my hand over my left eye, the right eye being the one closest to the sun, all the colors were bleached. They were all the reds and blues had bleached away, and the colors were oranges and reds and yellows, rather like old film in the
really,
days.
Your vision
had changed, yeah. The left eye was still saturated. Hmm. And this is something that happens, that our brains do become rewired according to the sorts of things we see and the experiences that we have. After a couple of weeks, it got back to normal. So in one sense, there was an instrumental effect of being outside in a particular kind of landscape where the light, of course, by the coast, the light comes from two directions. It comes from the sky and it bounces off the water and comes from another direction. So there's always a luminosity, hence the title of the book. There's always a different sense to the light and how it affects you. So that's at one level. At another level, it's really about the kind of creation of a story land around the coast, which I'll carry forever.
You talk about creating memory maps.
I like picking things up. So I carry stuff back. So if I find a bird's bone or a feather or a particular stone or an encrusted shell or something kind of unusual, I'll pick them up from a particular place, and I have several boxes, which I call memory boxes, that are full of sorts of things that I've picked up on my travels. And I know the story associated with each of them.
So what were some of your most memorable experiences during this year of walking?
Yeah, I think quite often they were little things that touch you in a particular way. I spent one day walking around the whole of a peninsula between Essex and Suffolk, and it's a 16-mile walk around about Easter time, and it snowed and it rained and it was sunny and it was cold and it was wet and it was hot. It was every type of weather on that day. And I didn't see a single other person whilst I was walking. The place was closed. And the night before I walked, I had read quite a famous essay by Annie Dillard, American writer, wonderful writer, a fierce writer. And she wrote about meeting a weasel and looking a weasel in the eye. And it was this kind of eye-to-eye interaction. I'd read this the night before. I was walking along the seawall, and this was in my mind. It was just ticking along. I was with nobody else. And then running along the seawall towards me were two weasels. And they ran right up to my up to my feet, and they went up on their hind legs as they do. And I lay down on the ground and looked them in the eye. And they just kind of looked at me. And we just looked at each other for about a minute. And then they gambled off into the grass. They call them a gang of weasels if there's more than one. And there was something kind of touching about that. I'm sure that'll not happen again in my life. Hmm. You know, sometimes things happen that are kind of numinous. They absolutely, that's it. That's the happening that you can remember.
I guess the question is how deep that goes. I mean, obviously a wonderful experience, sort of momentary. You know, they were there 1 minute, gone the next. Does that stay with you?
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, I think what you get from that is a sense that you, through a bit of hard work sometimes, you need to get out onto the land in the broader sense, onto the coast here, to let things happen. I mean, it might be you see a particular big flock of geese flying in, 16,000 geese I watched one day flying across the marches. Or it might be just the light on the water or something kind of very small that becomes special. I think we have to be there to see them.
Well, I mean, you also have to be receptive. You have to be open to have those kinds of experiences, to even notice them.
Yes, yes you do. And that's why I couch this idea of walking as being a kind of way to understand ourselves. It's both the journey outwards as well as the journey inwards. And of course, what I'm trying to do is to then write about it in a way that's not a rather dreary plod about walking from one place to the next place, you know, but going from what I call earthland to storyland, that when you walk in from A to B. When you travel, you go from A to B. If you write from A to B, it's boring.
Can you tell me about one or two other especially memorable experiences?
One of the most memorable is on the South Essex coast. There's a large area of the sea that is revealed as flat sands at low tide. It's called the Maplin Sands. And on the Maplin Sands is an ancient wet road, it's called. And so in order to get to one of the islands up the coast, you have to walk half a kilometre out onto the sands, turn left and walk about 6 or 7 miles north, and then turn left again. And it was a deliberately made wet road with hazel wattles put down to stabilise it.
Now, is this dependent on the tide?
Yes, at high tide, it's under the water. And when the tide comes in, it's rushing mighty fast. So you have to really know what you're doing when you're out there. And the light is dramatic. Distant ships levitate in mirages of heat when it's in summer. In winter, it's cold and windy and full of birds. There's a drama about the landscape when you leave the land and put yourself at the mercy of the sea in that kind of way.
You must feel like you know the place where you live now much better than you used to.
Oh, definitely, yes. And I mean, one of the things I did early on was to buy lots of maps. And when you look at maps, even very high detail ones, you'll see that there are lots of empty places, empty quarters. And you think, well, what's going on there? Apparently nothing. Once I discovered, this is along the Thames shore at a place called Tilbury, a part of the beach is lined on the inside by an old Victorian tip, and the Victorian waste then migrates onto the beach through the action of the water.
Wait, the Victorian waste?
Well, from London, what happened was that in order to get the waste out of London, they put it on barges and travelled up into the dark marshes, think Great Expectations and Pip and Magwitch in the kind of smoky, misty marshes. Hmm. Well, they brought the rubbish and just dumped it on the marshes and then came back in again with their empty barges. So all the beach is covered with pieces of porcelain and bottles and ivory toothbrushes and all kinds of old Victorian waste.
Still there?
Still there, yep, still there.
So did you go trash picking then?
Yes, and there's a kind of edge to this, which is that in 1842, the government at the time signed off the Cemeteries Act in central London because all the cemeteries were full. And what that meant was that they disinterred skeletons from graveyards in central London and took them out and dumped them on the marshes at that time. And so actually this beach at Tilbury is covered with pieces of human bone. There's no sand on the beach. It's all made up of tiny pieces of brick and porcelain and tile and human remains as well. Wow. There's nothing there at all.
Talk about encountering history. Sort of this very visceral sense.
Exactly. And it's an encounter with yourself. It's an encounter with surprise. It's a recognition that something is, you've discovered something that yes, some people know about, but they haven't kind of made a point of it or written about it. And you can collect old Victorian bottles, you know, blue and brown and all sorts of medicine shapes and different kinds of things that some people like to collect. But there's, again, a couple of those went into my memory box.
Jules Preddy's book about walking England's eastern edge is called The Luminous Coast. He talked with Steve Paulson. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, film critic Manola Dargis shares her favorite film of the year, and British comedian John Cleese tells stories from the Monty Python glory days. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hello, it's Michelle Faber here, author of The Crimson Petal and the White and The Book of Strange New Things. And the book that I'd like to recommend is Kurt Vonnegut's God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater. It was a very influential book on me. It was tackling something which very, very seldom gets tackled in fiction. Vonnegut was interested in people who are deeply, genuinely unlovable. For example, Diana Moon Glampers, who he describes as too dumb to live. There was no reason why anyone should love her. She was ugly, stupid, and boring. What Vonnegut is tackling there is the reality of the fact that on this planet, there are people who are too dumb to live, who are stupid, ugly, and boring, and yet they are human beings. And there is the challenge of loving them. In this novel, Mr. Rosewater, Elliot Rosewater, sets up a charitable foundation where he answers the phone all day and night, giving counseling and just moral support to people who are too dumb to live. There's a shyster lawyer who is aware that Elliot Rosewater is the heir to the Rosewater fortune, and that if it can be proved that he is insane, then he cannot be the heir to this fortune. It will pass to a different member of the Rosewater family, who this lawyer is hoping to siphon funds from. It's a satire on wealth and social provision, but it is also a very serious look at loving the unlovable. I found this immensely touching and impressive when I read it as a young person, because I was moving in very arrogant, avant-garde, arty circles. In those sorts of circles, there is a lot of implicit contempt for the average Joe, you know, the person who cannot appreciate avant-garde music, who doesn't read William Burroughs. It challenged me about that arrogance and confronted me with my own lack of sympathy or empathy for those who were just in a lower strata in every way. And it helped me develop my potential for compassion, which I think has shown in all my own writing, this need and this urge to find the human lovability in all creatures, regardless of how different or how alien from me they might be.
Michelle Faber recommends God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater by Kurt Vonnegut. You can find more bookmarks and an interview with Faber on our website at ttbook.org. British comedian John Cleese has kept several generations of people laughing. There's something kind of ageless about his humor, from the Monty Python sketches like The Ministry of Silly Walks and The Cheese Shop, to his unforgettable role as the neurotic hotel manager in Fawlty Towers. Well, now Cleese has finally written an autobiography. Looking back over his career, it's called So Anyway, and Doug Gordon loved it.
John, why did you decide to write your autobiography at this particular point in your life?
It started about 15 years ago, and I was having lunch with Michael Caine. He'd just written his, and he was going on about what a delightful experience it was. And I said, well, what was so special about it? He said, you start reclaiming parts of your life that were completely lost. And I thought, that is marvelous. I want that experience. I like writing that because it's so dignified. You can start when you want to and finish when you want to. You just have to hand it in on an agreed date. I started about 2 years ago. Took altogether about 2 years to do it, and it's the most enjoyable thing I've done for a very, very long time.
That's great to hear, and that comes across. It's a very enjoyable thing to read. So,
excuse me asking this, but genuinely, what is enjoyable to you?
Your life is very interesting.
Oh, you see, you think that. I don't think it's very interesting when I compare it with people who've been in wars and spies and people who've discovered rivers in Africa. It seems a bit tame, but I suppose it's pretty interesting compared with most people who spend their lives going into an office, yeah.
Well, yeah, and plus you discovered and invented a new kind of comedy.
Okay, I see what you mean. I ask you, see, because when I'm in front of an audience, I can tell what they like and what they think is funny because they laugh or they don't laugh, and I can note all that. But when you write a book, you sort of, it's a bit like contacting planets in the solar system. You sort of send out a signal, i.e. the book, and then you sit there and remarkably little feedback comes back.
You say that you sometimes suspect that what you seem to laugh at more are the things that frighten you.
Well, yes, I have absolutely no proof of this because it would be impossible, I think, to construct experiments. But when I began to look at what I laughed at, I realized that a lot of the sketches that I wrote with Graham Chapman were about people arguing. Mm-hmm. Not just the argument sketch itself, but a lot of the other, there was a sort of frustration of people not being able to understand each other. And then I realized that a lot of the humor in Fawlty Towers is me and Manuel not being able to understand each other. And I think that one of my fears was that I didn't really communicate emotionally with my mother. There was no real empathy between us. So I think that that must have been scary for me when I was young. So maybe I try to laugh at lack of communication to kind of feel, oh, it's not that important anyway. And my mother, because she was neurotic, she used to get into terrible tantrums. And I think I've often laughed or done stuff that's laughing at anger, but at a particular kind of anger, which is an ineffectual anger. One thinks of how worked up Basil gets. But it's not because he's fundamentally an angry person. It's that he's terrified that Sybil's going to find something out or that a health inspector is going to discover there's a rat in the kitchen. And he gets so frantic to avoid this, it all coming out of fear, that he becomes very frustrated and angry. But it's not effectual anger. It doesn't get him anywhere.
Exactly. What else, besides things that you're afraid of, what else makes you laugh? What do you find funny?
Oh, almost everything. I've always had a very Catholic sense of humor. I can read quite dry, witty stuff or watch comedies of manners, as they call them, and be very entertained. What I notice is the stuff that really makes me howl with laughter, that leaves me weak and helpless and almost joyful with the experience, is something that's more like farce, where the characters become very, very wound up by the circumstances. And as they get more wound up, there's that wonderful phrase from the book Emotional Intelligence. The phrase is, stress makes you stupid. As they get more and more stressed, they make more and more stupid decisions and then get more and more stressed. And I find that that high emotional charge on that kind of humor seems to elicit more laughter from me than quieter, calmer, even possibly more sophisticated humor. So that's why probably I write Fawlty Towers, because they're basically little farces.
Sure. There was an incident that occurred in Washington, D.C. when you were touring with a theatrical review show. I think this would have been in the early 60s.
Yeah, 65.
Yeah, something that you still think about. Can you tell me about that?
We were in Hyde Park on the university campus in Chicago, and we went to a bar afterwards. And this guy came over to read our palms. And when he read my palm, he said, "This is a very unusual palm," he said, "because the creativity and the logic are almost exactly balanced in equal proportions." And that struck me, it stuck in my mind for some reason. I didn't know anything about palmistry, but I thought to myself afterwards, you know, I think that's why I can do comedy quite well, because I can have the ideas, but I also have a reasonable sort of logical, critical mind. So when I've got an idea, I can figure out which are the best bits of that and how I should construct it to get most value out of it.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious, do you think this balance of logic and creativity is responsible for you and Graham writing a sketch like the Python classic, The Argument Clinic?
Yes, I think so, because Gray was trained in science. I got into Cambridge on science, although I switched to law, and he was a medic, you see. So both of us had this basic training in what they call the scientific way of thinking, which is to come up with a theory or a hypothesis at that stage and then to test it experimentally. And I think we were more likely to take that slightly intellectual approach to what we were doing than the two Oxford guys who'd read English and history and who were a little more instinctive than we were, which meant that they produced a material, not that it was worse than ours, but that it was different from us.
Yeah, Terry Jones and Michael Palin.
That's right. Because when you've got a team, what you want more than anything, Doug, is a mixture of different talents. You don't want everyone to be good at the same things, because then you don't need the team.
You wrote most of your sketches, your Python sketches, with Graham Chapman, and one of the most famous sketches that you two wrote together is The Cheese Shop. Can you tell me how you and Graham came up with that idea?
I was going down to the south coast of England to film something that needed to be shot on a boat. When I got there, the water was already rough, and they said, "Yeah, but we're not going out of the harbor." When I finally got dressed up as one of those Python pepper pots, oh, yes, that's right, Jean-Paul came over for dinner. I was feeling terrible. I was seasick as a dog. And then the director said, "Action," and I came up the steps rapidly and looked into the camera and said, "Oh, yes, one of the..." And I threw up all over the camera, which caused a certain amount of annoyance among the crew. And the car back with Graham sitting in the back, I remember, he said, "You should eat something." And I thought, yeah, he's probably right. I should put something in my stomach. So he said, "What do you feel like?" I said, "I feel like some cheese." And he said, "All right, well, let's look for somewhere." And we looked for lots of shops, but there weren't many shops. And eventually we went past a drugstore, what we would call a chemist. And I said, "Do you think they'd have any cheese?" And Gray laughed and said, "Well, if they did, it would be medicinal cheese." And we loved the idea of medicinal cheese. So we sat down literally the next day to write about someone going into a drugstore to buy cheese. And we thought, but why would he go into a drugstore? And obviously because he'd been to the cheese store and they didn't have any. So we started to write that, and we never got around to writing the second half of it.
"And what is the most popular cheese round here?"
"Ilchester, sir."
"Is it?"
"Oh, yes, sir. It's staggeringly popular in this manor square."
"Is it?"
"It's our number one bestseller, sir."
"I see. Ilchester, eh?"
"Right, sir."
"All right. Eh? Have you got any?" he asked, expecting the answer no.
"I'll have a look, sir." "No."
"It's not much of a cheese shop, is it?"
"Finest in the district, sir."
"Explain the logic underlying that conclusion, please."
"Well, it's so clean, sir."
"It's certainly uncontaminated by cheese."
And with the cheese shop sketch, if I recall correctly, you started writing it, and then you didn't think it was funny, and Graham had to tell you...
"That's quite right, Doug. I kept losing confidence in it."
"Because you were ready to abandon it. So this shows the importance of working in teams and why you like it."
"Yes, because Gray just sat there saying, 'No, it's funny, it's funny.' And what I'd learned earlier on in my career, I was much more dubious about what was funny or whether I was writing something funny. But if Graham laughed, the audience were going to laugh. It was extraordinary. He was just programmed like a tuning fork, and you just had to sort of watch him. And if he was laughing, then you said, 'Fine, it's going to be funny.'" And one of the interesting things about writing the book is that I know now that what I write when I'm trying to be funny will be funny, but I don't know if it's going to be a tiny little bit funny or a lot funny. And that's why I'm asking people about the book, because I think some of it's hilarious. The story about the rabbit on Salisbury Plain, I think, is the funniest thing I've written for 20 years. But the funny thing is, not too many people mention it. And you think, do they think I'm going to be bored if they start talking? So you're seeking the feedback that you would get from a live audience.
Yeah. Maybe time to bring back the live novel writing with Thomas Hardy.
Quite right.
And here he goes, the first word of Thomas Hardy's new novel at 10:35 on this very lovely morning. It's three letters, it's the definite article, and it's the Dennis.
Well, this is true to form. No surprises there. He started 5 of his 11 novels to date with a definite article.
I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Dennis, but he's crossed it out. Thomas Hardy here on the first day of his new novel has crossed out the only word he's written so far, and he's gazing off into space.
Is there a question that you've never been asked but have always wanted to be asked? Because if there is, I'd be happy to ask it right now.
No, you've just asked it.
Okay. John... Thank you so very much. It's been a real pleasure and an honor to talk to you. I can now die a happy man.
Yes, this moment will flash before your eyes when you lie there on your deathbed. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So thank you, John. Pleasure. And congratulations. Thanks. Again on the book. It is indeed hilarious.
I'm so glad you thought it was funny.
It's very funny.
That's like hearing an audience laugh. Thanks.
John Cleese is a comedy legend and author of the new memoir called So Anyway. He talked with Doug Gordon. And that's it for this hour. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Raymond Tungekar, Charles Monroe Kane, and Craig Ely. Opening theme music by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Till next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.